False Spirituality. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 through chapter 14. The third talk in a series titled Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity was presented by Ron Julian on January 23, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
So, this is the third in our series on historical alternatives to biblical Christianity. We're still tonight going to look at a particular problem, distortion of the gospel that showed up in the New Testament itself. And tonight we're going to be primarily in chapters 12 through 14 of 1 Corinthians. We're talking about problems associated with the charismatic gifts. And we're not talking about today, we're talking about something that happened 2 millennia ago. So let me make it clear what my purpose is tonight. And as soon as I make clear what my purpose is, you're all going to say, well, why don't we just go home? But that's all right. We would all perhaps like answers to these questions. What is the true gift of speaking in tongues? What is a prophet? Do these gifts continue today? What's going on with those Kansas City prophets and those blessings up in Canada and all that stuff, huh? Okay, well, I don't know. I don't think that those kinds of questions are easy to answer from 1 Corinthians. But from my perspective, this passage does something even more important. It's been a crucially important passage for me, one that I've... It has had a big impact on the way I think about things. Because this passage gives us perspective, I think, on the notion of spirituality. It gives us a foundation to build on, and it does give us something to work with to evaluate various claims of spiritual phenomena out there. It seems to me that at a minimum, such phenomena have to fit into the picture that's being painted in 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, or it's really not a work of God at all. So I'm not prepared to say. I am prepared to believe that the modern phenomenon of speaking in tongues is in fact the biblical phenomenon of speaking in tongues. I don't at this moment believe that it is, but I'm not against believing it. I could be convinced. Likewise, I would be willing to believe that there are prophets in the what I understand to be the New Testament sense of that today. I don't think so, but I would be prepared to believe it. But what I am convinced of is that this model that we see in 1 Corinthians has to be the framework within which we think about such things. And if we're not thinking about it within that framework, then we're not thinking about it right. So That's kind of what I want to try to get across in real general sorts of terms. This is like, you know, we're talking three chapters and we can't, let me put it this way. I'm going to be real general as I go along. You may try to pin me down and you can try, but I want to just kind of give a feeling for what I think is happening. The issue is, we can see it in the first verse in 1 Corinthians 12, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be unawares." The word that's translated spiritual gifts there is actually, it's just the word spiritual. It's concerning spiritual things, the spiritual stuff. It's not spiritual gifts in the sense of that technical term that we think of as, you know, do you have the gift of teaching or do you have the gift of helps or that sort of thing. It's concerning the spiritual things. What we need to understand when we look at that is that in our culture, I think the word spiritual kind of gets misused. I mean, we talk about something having a spiritual kind of sound, and what we tend to mean is it's ethereal and otherworldly sounding or something like that. You know, we talk about someone being a spiritual person, and most of the time, I mean, we may be talking about something objectively true about them, but all we're really saying is, you know, they're interested in religious questions, or, you know, they have a spacey kind of way of looking at things, they believe in UFOs, or, you know, something, any number of things might come under that category. The question that Paul's dealing with when he's talking about the spiritual things is a particular kind of issue, that God, through the Spirit of God, or the gods, as the pagans would have looked at it, makes himself known, manifests himself in the world, in the lives of people, in various ways. And the spiritual things are those things that have to do with the manifestation of the Spirit. So if the Spirit has you speaking in tongues, then that's one of the spiritual things. If the Spirit has manifested itself by revealing something in your mind, then that's one of the spiritual things. If the Spirit has brought you to an understanding that Jesus is the Christ, then that's one of the spiritual things. The issue is the manifestation of the Spirit. That's the issue that the Corinthians were concerned about, and they had asked Paul a question about it. That's what he's going to deal with in these chapters. And really, the questions from Paul's perspective are questions like, what is true spirituality? I mean, what is a manifestation of the Spirit? How should we think about these manifestations of the Spirit that you guys are so concerned about, like the tongues and miracles and so on? How can we get perspective on that and put that all together? That's what he's trying to do in this section. Okay, so he said, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and we just talked about verse 1, so I'm starting in verse 2. You know that when you were pagans, you were led astray to the dumb idols, however you were led. Therefore I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God says Jesus is accursed, and no one can say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. Now this is one of the hardest points actually to see, I think, but I'm pretty convinced at this point that this is the way we need to understand this. What I want to do is sort of highlight a series of mistakes that I think the Corinthians have made in their understanding of spirituality, and show how Paul is addressing those mistakes. So my assertion would be that what we just read there... So mistake number one is thinking that spirituality is marked by flashy supernatural manifestations like speaking in tongues. What I see Paul doing is alluding to their pagan background, where they were led away before the dumb idols. So the idols were dumb, but they were very well already familiar with, you know, phenomenons of ecstatic utterances and, you know, falling into trances and, you know, all kinds of strange stuff before the idols that they worshipped. And, you know, I really do think it's important for us, just as seekers after the truth, to understand that the phenomenon, the kinds of phenomena that we see in the charismatic movement today, are phenomena that have been happening in religious traditions for, you know, for a long time. You can find them in many traditions outside of Christianity today. In fact, we had a very interesting conversation with someone a while ago who... There's a girl who was not a believer, but she had gone to one of the meetings of the Vineyard Church where people were speaking in tongues and laughing hysterically and barking like dogs and all of this stuff, and she freaked out, and she had to leave the place because she had earlier in her life had been in India and seen a religious meeting there, and exactly the same thing had been happening. Speaking in tongues, laughing hysterically, barking like dogs, all of it. She had seen it before. Well, but it wasn't a Christian group that she had seen. So we need to recognize that these phenomena are out there and were presumably, very likely, a part of what the Corinthians would have known already in their pagan background. So Paul wants to say to them, I mean, the emphasis, as I see it, is, therefore I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God says Jesus is accursed, and no one can say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. The question is, are you marked as a spiritual person by what comes out of your mouth? And he's saying, yeah, but not the kind of stuff that you guys are familiar with in your background before. You're marked as a spiritual person if what comes out of your mouth is Jesus is Lord. And, I mean, obviously you'd be a hypocrite, but I mean, what he's saying is to say and mean that Jesus is Lord is a mark of true spirituality. That's the Holy Spirit working. And likewise, if you're saying the opposite, then I don't care what else is coming out of your mouth, that's not the Holy Spirit that's at work there. So the first thing that he wants to point out to them is, look, the Spirit of God, when he moves, one of the fundamental things that marks it is faith in the life of the person that we're talking about, saying Jesus is Lord, having come to the place where you acknowledge who Jesus is and see where you stand in relationship to him. That's a miraculous thing. The person whose mouth can say that is the person whose mouth has been taken hold of by the Spirit of God. That's, you know, if you think about the phenomenon of speaking in tongues, whatever you think about it, and Paul doesn't look down on it, whatever it is that he's describing. He later in 14 speaks well of it. He's not saying it's phony in all of its manifestations, and clearly Acts describes something that went on with people's mouths when the Spirit came. But what Paul's saying is, if you want to know what the mark of spirituality is, the mark of spirituality is faith, confessing that Jesus is Lord. Okay. Now, let's read on a little bit then from verse 4. Now there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. And there are varieties of ministries, and the same Lord. And there are varieties of effects, but the same God who works all things in all persons. But to each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, and to another the word of knowledge according to the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, and to another gifts of healing by the one Spirit, and to another the effecting of miracles, and to another prophecy, and to another the distinguishing of spirits, to another various kinds of tongues, and to another the interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually just as he wills. Now, again, I hope I'm not just disappointing you terribly, but my purpose tonight is to talk about the distortion of the Christian faith that arose in Corinth, and understanding what Paul is proposing as an alternative to it. So I have no purpose, it's not my intention to go through that list and describe what each of those things is. You know, what is the word of knowledge and all of that kind of stuff. That's not my purpose tonight. What we want to look at is his big argument. Whatever those things individually are, what is he saying? He's saying that the one Spirit of God has decided to dish these various things out to various people. So, mistake number two is thinking that the manifestations of the Spirit will be the same in everyone. And you can understand how that mentality might develop. Something like speaking in tongues is a very obvious thing. I mean, you know, wow, God has gotten a hold of his mouth. And so, it would be very easy for someone to start thinking, if God hasn't got a hold of your mouth, then you must not really be a spiritual person. So what Paul is trying to say to them here is, look, the Spirit, this one Spirit that each believer has at work in him, is deciding to distribute variously these gifts. One of the most important things we can understand about the working of the Spirit in overtly supernatural or more subtle ways, is to understand that there are many things that the Spirit does that are distributed differently. Not everybody gets the same job. Not everybody has the same thing happening in them. So This helps us to see that right off, when we think about the work of the Spirit, we need to think about the distinction between those things that the Spirit does in common in everyone versus those things that are variously and individually distributed. This is really important when we come to passages, all sorts of passages, where we have to decide when a particular work of the Spirit is being described, is this one of those individual phenomena that may or may not happen in the life of someone else? Or are we talking about one of those common works of the Spirit that is true of every believer? I would argue, if you go and look at the Bible, what it clearly indicates as the common work of the Spirit, that work that it has in common in every believer, is stuff like regeneration, faith, encouraging us to in our persevering in our faith, sanctification, bringing us finally to our inheritance. Those things are described often as the work of the Spirit that the apostles expected that the Spirit would be doing in the lives of believers, just believers, period. Vanilla believers. On the other hand, on an individual basis, we see things like apostleship. Not everyone is an apostle. Not everyone is a prophet. Not everyone is a teacher. Not everyone is a healer, and so on. So that distinction right there by itself, I think, is a crucial one for us to understand, that distinction holds. And from Paul's perspective, you can see him putting an awful lot of stuff that the Corinthians are talking about, tongues, miracles, healing, but also apostleship and teaching and prophecy and all kinds of it. He's putting all of that in that individual category. God does this variously as he wants to. That's what God has set out to do. Okay? Now, to pursue this point further, Paul goes on to make a metaphor comparing the human body with its various parts to the collection of believers. And that starts in 12. For even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by the Spirit we were all baptized, by one Spirit, we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and we were all made to drink of one Spirit. And we can stop right there. What he's saying is, look, if you think about a body has these various individual members and parts, but they are united. They're brought together. I mean, it's a physical uniting that unites the parts of the body, but they are this one thing together. Well, the metaphor of the body is a good one, he's saying, for the collection of people that belong to Christ, because we are united by something as well. We are individuals with differences, but we are united the way the pieces of the body are united. And what unites us is this one Spirit that we all drink of. The Spirit of God is at work in every one of God's children. Not just the ones that speak in tongues, and not just the ones that do healings, and not just apostles, but every believer drinks of this Spirit. And that, essentially then, that unity, the fact that God's work is happening in each one of these people, brings them together as a unit. They are in this thing together, the way the members of a body are together. For the body is not one member, but many. Now we're talking about, let's be clear here, he's going to explore this human body metaphor. So the body is not one member, but many. We're saying a body, I'm not one big nose, but I have all series of parts. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body, it is not for this reason any the less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body, it is not for this reason any the less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole body were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? But now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body just as he desired. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now there are many members, but one body. Okay, so I think it's legitimate to say that we are kind of concentrating on one part. I'm calling this mistake 2A. Thinking that I am lacking because I am not the same as someone else. So here you notice in his analogy we have the one part saying, oh, I'm not a part of the body because I'm not like the eye or whatever. It's that sort of that feeling of lack in yourself. Oh, there must be something wrong with me. And I think that he's putting it in those terms because that's the experience of some of the people in Corinth, that they're saying of themselves, I must not be a part of this body because I don't have, I see those guys speaking in tongues or whatever, but I don't, and so there must be something wrong with me. I must not have this spirit. I'm not a spiritual person the way they are. But notice how he's emphasizing here again, God designed it this way. God designed a body to have various parts that function in various ways. And I think Paul wants us to grab a hold of how reasonable that is. I mean, how much sense it makes that the body is made up of various parts. It's just, that's the way you would do it, right? It's not, you don't think of parts of the body as being deficient because they don't do everything. Because that would be silly. Because it's the body you think of. It's the person that is made by the whole thing. And likewise, if the Corinthians would understand that God designed it from the beginning to be that people have different roles to play and the Spirit does different things in various ones, then they wouldn't be tempted to think of themselves, to respond to the pressure from some of those others and say, oh, they're right, there must be something wrong with me. Because there isn't. That's the way God intends it to be. And likewise, 21, and the eye can, right? Right. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Or again, the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor. And our unseemly members come to have more abundant seemliness, whereas our seemly members have no need of it. But God has so composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, that there should be no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Well, there are a number of complicated things in there, and I'm not sure I'm up to tackling all of them right here. But let's notice one thing, at least, that's happening here. I'm calling mistake 2B, thinking that you are lacking because you're not like me, which is kind of the flip side of it. And that's, notice, see his analogy here. This time, instead of the ear saying, because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body, this time, the eye is saying to the hand, I have no need of you. It's the other way around. It's, you know, look, you're not like me, so what do I need you for? Which is obviously, I mean, ridiculous. If you think about the body, I mean, that's what he's saying, is that couldn't happen. That would be so ridiculous for one part of the body to say to the other one, you know, for the eye to look at the hand and say, you're no good at looking at stuff. What do I need you for? I mean, that's, it's ridiculous because that's the whole point. The eye is already good at looking at stuff. It needs the hand to pick up the stuff that it's looking at. So that's, you wouldn't even think such a thing. But that's what Paul is saying. The thing that the differences and the unity that mark us have that same sort of logic. We are different and yet we're united. We have a common purpose. We have a thing that is the same about us, that ought to drive us in the same direction. Like the parts of the body, we all ought to be valuable to each other. And although there are some complications to sort out there, I think that one thing is clear, that we're, as we're going to see as we go along here, there, some parts in the body play a larger role than others. I mean, the eye is pretty significant when compared to the fingernail or something like that. I mean, you know, there's really no mistaking that. And the same thing is true when it comes to the roles that God has given in the body. I think we want to be clear about this. Paul is not saying that an apostle's job is no more significant than anybody else's job, because that's not true. It is more significant. They're, in one sense, if we're talking about the impact on the world, there's no question but that Paul had a bigger impact on the world than any of us in this room will ever possibly attain to. It's just, I think that's just a given, unless something really bizarre happens that I'm not expecting. So, but what Paul's argument is that we don't think about our body in those terms. It's all a part of me. It's all together. So that there is an honor to being in the body. There is a mutual concern to being in the body that is there, whether we're talking about one of the really big players like the eye, or just, you know, one of the minor, you know, whatever that might be. That there is a mutual concern there, and what he's suggesting is that the Corinthians have got this all turned around. They have used the variety of the gifts as a means of dividing. They're saying, well, see, you don't have this gift, so you're not with me. But that's the whole point. It doesn't matter. Those gifts were given out variously. That was God's whole purpose. But what unites us is this common spirit, this common destiny, this common work of God, these common concerns. We're in this together. What unites us is more significant than what is different about us. So the differences are there, and they're worth noting, but not when it comes to the way we treat each other, not when it comes to the way we honor each other. We each deserve an equal honor from each other because we're in this thing together. Roger?
You were making a distinction between the, say, the eye and the fingernail, and I think you were saying that the eye was, you were equating that with being an apostle, and that was more significant than the fingernail.
So you're going to argue with me that the fingernail is just as significant as the eye is?
I would like to give you two other parts of the body and see how you would respond.
Okay.
How about the eye and the liver? Now, the reason I ask that is because the first analogy is we're making a distinction about the significance. Mm-hmm. What's more significant?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't it be part of Paul's point that some positions in the church are more obvious, more
tangible?
Like being a teacher, being up front, is an obvious thing, but there are still other jobs in the church that are just as significant, but maybe behind the scenes.
Well,
to the people that are up front and neglect the people who are behind the scenes might be some people higher than others.
Right, really. Right. That, and I mean, and of course you've got me in a good position, because if I deny this, then obviously I'm just protecting my turf. I'm trying to make sure that I get all of the honor that I deserve. Here's my thinking on that. What you're saying, I think, is right. There's no question there are ways in which we obviously don't understand even the significance of, you know, the difference between the guy who's standing up front and the guy who never stands up front but just sort of quietly goes about being a faithful, obedient person who has this great impact on his family and the people around him, and struck by his integrity and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I absolutely grant you all of that stuff. And I suppose it's possible that that's a part of Paul's point. But the other part of the point that I was talking about, I think, is central to what he's saying, because when we're going to go on here and talk about the gifts, Paul is going to make a distinction between being a prophet, being an apostle, being a teacher, something like that, and speaking in tongues. Speaking in tongues is a manifestation of the Spirit, at least some of it is. But he's going to argue that there is a superiority to being an apostle or a prophet or a teacher or something like that, that it really is superior because it edifies. That is, when I'm a prophet, I proclaim the message of God and people benefit from the message of God. When I speak in tongues, I may be personally benefiting, he's saying, but nobody understands what in the world I'm saying. So it doesn't have that edifying quality of communicating the truth that then takes somebody to a spot where they have to confront the truth and make a choice in their life and that kind of stuff. So he's going to argue, see, that's what I was going to point at here in a minute, is he uses the language about the greater gifts. And what he means by a greater gift is one that is more significant because it serves the purposes of God in a more fundamental way. Now, see, you're right. We can argue that there are different kinds of edification, that being up front and proclaiming something may have not be any more edifying than living a life of principle and faith and encouraging people through your example and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, that may be right. But see, I would still say that Paul would say all of that stuff is on the one side of the picture, which is the edifying side, and then there are these other things that the Spirit does, which are interesting and they're good, but they're just not worthy to be put in the same category as these things. So I that's what I'm trying to get at, is that this is a part of the point that Paul is trying to make, is that it wouldn't matter how the Spirit was working in you, whether you were an apostle or whether you were just this guy that every now and again, you know, had, you know, spoken tongues and then there you have it. There's no question that the apostle would be more significant in terms of the impact, the positive impact on a large group of people, but we're not measuring how we honor each other by the significance of our impact, whether public or private or whatever. So what I want to argue for is that his point at least includes this idea that it's not just that the public role or the private role is just as significant as the public role, but it includes the idea the person is equally significant to every other person in the body, whether their role is significant or not. So there's this distinction between roles, which can be more or less significant, but people cannot be more or less significant. They have the same honor and significance, or they ought to, amongst themselves. And that's what he's trying to tell them, is you're looking at someone that doesn't have the gift of speaking in tongues, because they've elevated this gift of speaking in tongues to the top. And then they've said, and you're just not with it because you don't have this. He says, you've mistaken the whole thing. It wouldn't matter whether they have it or not, because by being together people of faith, you are people in whom the Spirit is working, and so you're in this together the way the hand and the eye are in it together. So what you're saying is a good point, and it may be a part of his point. I'm not sure about that. I can see how you might want to argue that, but it's a difficult little thing what he's doing with the unseemly members and that stuff. I've gone back and forth on that question. But what I want to hold out for is that at least a part of what he's saying is directed to their idea that I ought to be able to judge the worth of somebody out there because I can see that they don't do this thing that I do. What he's saying is, no, you can't do that, because it's more like a body where I don't reject one part of my body because it's less significant than the other parts. I don't care about that part. It's all me. That's what I understand him to be getting at.
Logan. In modern times,
when we look at someone who is doing, who is engaged in this phenomenon, the only problem we have is in defining the phenomenon, not in because you do this, you are lacking.
Right.
I mean, that
seems, right.
I hear that a lot.
Right.
And that's exactly what you're not saying. You're
right.
Saying, first, let's define the phenomenon.
Right. Yeah, as one who does not at this point believe that the modern phenomenon of speaking in tongues is the biblical phenomenon of speaking in tongues, nonetheless, I have to be careful about taking that stance. I mean, it would be a different kind of thing. It'd be kind of like, because I'm smart enough to know that this is bogus and you're not, then we're not in this together. That would be a bad thing from my perspective. If there's a place where I sort of pull back from that stuff, it is because in most of the time when I've, not all of the time actually, and I mean we know people who of whom you could say that this is not the case, but most of it that I'm familiar with is accompanied with teaching and perspective on what the Christian life is and what it's about that just is obviously not true to me and bad. I mean, unhealthy for a person to believe and pursue. And so my concern is more about that. It's not so much the teaching, the tongue stuff. I'm just worried that it's just all part of a package that they've bought into that's not healthy. But I don't think you have to buy into that package, because I know people who have experienced that gift of whom I think we ought to think very highly, have a very, very good understanding of what the Christian life is all about. And obviously it's people like that that sort of give me pause. Okay, so what is exactly going on with that stuff? But when I look out on it at large, I mean, what I see out there is not, it does not encourage me to think that that's the case. But see, I'm just saying, I mean, that's where I am right now. You don't have to think that because I say it. You don't have to think anything because I say it. But what's important for us to understand is you and I are being asked to respond to each other not on the basis of whatever cultural aspects of our Christianity may or may not be comfortable, but whether we can honestly embrace each other as believers. And if I feel like I can embrace you as a believer, then I have the obligation to do that in spite of my perspective on your, you know, giftedness and that stuff. Okay, now, I've alluded to this already. Let me read on a little bit more here. Now, you are Christ's body and individually members of it. And God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, administrations, various kinds of tongues. All are not apostles, are they? All are not prophets, are they? All are not teachers, are they? All are not workers of miracles, are they? All do not have gifts of healings, do they? All do not speak with tongues, do they? All do not interpret, do they? But earnestly desire the greater gifts. And he doesn't explain it here, but that's a significant phrase we're going to talk about in a minute. But I see mistake number three, then, is mistaking what would qualify one spiritual manifestation as more important than another. Because he does speak of the greater gifts. And I think it is significant the way he orders the list when he says first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, and so on. There is a kind of a hierarchy there that makes sense. That the apostles, in terms of their authority and the significance of what they have to contribute to the church, they're right to be listed first. And there's something entirely appropriate about that. But see, this is what's so strange about the Corinthians. They've made two mistakes. Their first mistake is saying, because you don't have the same gift I do, then we're not in this together. You're not a spiritual person. That's their first mistake. Second. That's what I'm describing as mistake number two there, is thinking that the manifestations of the Spirit will be the same in everyone. They're wrong in thinking about that. But they're further wrong in if you're going to judge someone for not having a particular gift, why would you choose the least significant of the gifts to judge someone by? That is, what Paul's saying is, look, if you're going to be zealous for spiritual gifts, then what you ought to be concerned about is the greater gifts. Not speaking in tongues, which he's going to go on to argue is a personal, at best, a personal sort of benefit, but the gifts that edify the church. So their two mistakes are using the roles that God has given them to judge each other's worthiness, and secondly, to misevaluate the roles so that they've used the least important role as their criteria for judging other people. So he's not saying they should be judging other people, but he's saying if you're going to be zealous for spiritual gifts, and if you can keep away from judging each other in the process, what you ought to be zealous about are the greater gifts, not the ones that are of least importance. So there's both of those things are a problem. To insist that everybody else needs to have the same gift that I do is presumptuous and arrogant. But to take the least important one and elevate it to be of most importance is to be foolish, is to have a screwy set of values. Because what we're going to see is what marks something as edifying, it's something that has the potential to help other people in the group. In other words, ultimately, it is a manifestation of love. The argument that the biblical authors use sometimes in talking about the gifts is we have this obligation to love each other, to help each other through what God has called us to do. Well, they've taken the one gift that has the least potential to be used lovingly towards anyone else because it doesn't do anything for anybody else, and they've elevated that and said, this is the gift that really counts. If you've got that, you're in, and otherwise you don't. So all the way around, their perspective is weird, and that's what he's trying to speak against. Okay, now, there's still another mistake in their perspective that he wants to address, and that's what chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians is all about. He says, and I show you a still more excellent way. And let me just comment that essentially what mistake number 4 is thinking that the lack of any spiritual gift could be of ultimate importance. You understand now? He's saying you shouldn't be judging each other based on the gifts. And you've got the wrong set of values on which gift is more important than the other. But now he's saying, I show you a still more excellent way. That is, we're going to step back. Let's take the whole pile of them, all of those gifts, and let's talk about the whole package. And I'm saying it's a mistake to think that lacking any of those things, I don't care whether it's being an apostle or speaking in tongues or moving mountains or whatever it might be, anything that any of those individual gifts that the Spirit gives out, lack of any of them is ultimately of ultimate importance. There are some things that are truly important that if you lacked them, you would really be lacking something important. But ultimately, the spiritual gifts are not among those things. Yes? Yeah.
We leave this, it says, but earnestly desire the greater gifts. Do I understand here? What he's saying is that we ourselves are not to specifically desire like the gift of healings or the gift of being an apostle or whatever, but we are to want to see those gifts manifested, or in their case, manifested so that they could be edified in a proper.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to understand that. I think that's how I would understand what he's talking about. And he's speaking into, see, later in chapter 14, he uses the language in 12. So also you, since you are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek to abound for the edification of the church. I mean, he's basically talking to people who are already really worked up about this spiritual gift stuff. And so he's basically saying, if you're going to be worked up about this, then what you ought to be worked up about is, let's have things happening where people are getting edified. That's the thing to be eager for. Yeah, I think you're right. It's not so much, I really want to be an apostle. God, please make me an apostle. I think it's too late. Yes?
Now, who is it exactly that he's talking to, and why are they so worked up about spiritual gifts? Is it because of an event that happened to them, where everybody got gifts and then they're excited, or is it more from the perspective of their pagan experiences with that
person? We don't know exactly. I mean, we're trying to sort of piece this together. You know, you kind of deduce what the problem was from the nature of the argument that he is making back to them. But
Christians.
Well, I think the best way to think about it is that he is speaking to a group of people, some of whom are Christians and some of whom probably are not. Because some of the people in Corinth are enemies of Paul. Earlier in the book, he's addressed this problem where there are people who are denying that he is an apostle. There are people who have split up into factions, and they would say, I'm of Apollos, and it kind of makes it clear there, I am not of Paul. Paul is bogus. Apollos is great. Paul is bogus. Well, his argument throughout this whole letter is basically he's dealing with errors that are so severe that they could really mark somebody that is just a total fool and not really a believer at all. So I don't think we can say he's talking to Christians exactly, because, I mean, yes, his hope is that, and he knows that there are some there who are, but some of the ones, especially the ones who are fighting his teaching and who are causing a lot of trouble, I think he doesn't really have a very high view of them. This section concludes in chapter 14 with, in verse 37, he says, if anyone thinks he is a prophet or spiritual, let him recognize that the things which I write to you are the Lord's commandment. But if anyone does not recognize this, he is not recognized. So, I mean, he's talking to people who, some of the people who are involved in this charismatic stuff that he's talking to are holding themselves up as prophets above Paul, saying, you ought to be listening to us. We have the word of God on this stuff. And what he's saying is, well, if you're going to put yourself forward as someone that has the word of God on this matter, then that word had better be saying that I, Paul, am an apostle, and what I've told you about this is true. If you're not, if your message is I'm a prophet of God and Paul is bogus and don't listen to him, then you're not recognized. He's saying you have no place in this. You're claiming to be of God, but you're not.
Some of these people would be not so much Judaizers. They wouldn't be Judaizers.
No,
it would be more people that were based in some sort of paganistic,
yes,
Gnosticism.
Right.
Frame of mind.
Right. He is not dealing with Jewish opponents in Corinth. He is dealing with, you can see it in the first chapters where he's talking about the divisions among them and is talking about worldly wisdom and how it doesn't really hold up. I think there's evidence that the perspective of the people that he's writing to is influenced by the sort of model of debate and wisdom in Greek culture, and they're saying basically that Paul, you don't measure up by what we've seen, you know, with the sophists, the orators, the debaters, you know, you are just not very impressive, and so I think a lot of their perspectives come out of their Greek culture. I suspect, just in another chapter or two here, when we get to chapter 15, there's another big argument, and that is that some of them are saying there's no resurrection from the dead. Well, and Paul's saying, well, great, how are you going to be a Christian and not believe in resurrection from the dead? Did you hear about Jesus, you know, the resurrection from the dead? But we know from the evidence from Acts that, like when Paul goes to Mars Hill and gives his talk, that there are many of the, you know, the wise men, the philosophers there and the at Mars Hill, who when he talks about Jesus being raised from the dead, they scoff at him and say, oh, okay, well now we know that you obviously don't have anything worth listening to because we don't believe in such things. We know, our philosophy tells us that resurrection from the dead would be a superstitious idea that has no merit. Well, again, see, it seems as if there's a faction in Corinth that has bought into the prevailing, you know, sort of the politically correct philosophy of the time, you know, and what he's... So, yeah, that's right.
Well, the feeling that I get from 2 Corinthians, which could be his third letter, is that apparently a lot of the people there had at least either repented or something had happened. Either maybe there was a break-off, I don't know what was going on there. So there was sort of a healing process.
Yes, although if you read the last part of 2 Corinthians, it's striking, really. The first part, you're right, is fairly sort of has a nice peacemaking sort of tone. You get to the second part of 2 Corinthians, and it is the nastiest stuff that Paul ever writes anywhere. He is, I mean, I'm not criticizing him, but I mean, it is incredibly sarcastic. And that's where his critics come into view there, where he describes them as saying that that Paul's speech is unimpressive, and his personal presence is contemptible or something like that. And I mean, so there, clearly, there's still, even at the end of 2 Corinthians, there still exists a body of people who are resisting. Yeah, I think, but he had very tempestuous relationship with them. Logan?
Would it be safe to say that these people, at least the fraction of them that are not believers, are just pursuing the same thing in the Christian religion that they were pursuing in the pagan religion?
Yeah. In fact, I think he's implying that, if I'm understanding.
Something's never changed.
Yeah. And you know, he can say that in a lot of different ways. He says that here, I believe, regarding this issue, but he can also say that it's striking how when the issue is what the Judaizers are saying to that we talked, you know, like what we talked about last week, to the Galatians, who are largely, you know, Gentile pagans, in essence, he's saying by listening to the Judaizers and embracing the Old Testament law as a way of being justified, it's like you're going back to your paganism again. And that's a kind of an eye-opener. I mean, that one kind of makes you sort of stop and think, now, wait a minute, what does he mean by that? But I think that's what he's saying, that in essence, he sees, in a sense, there's a kind of an error that all kinds of religious systems can promote that the gospel is the antidote to, and that you can go back to the Old Testament, but you're really embracing the same error that you had when you were a pagan. So, okay, now, where am I? Okay, mistake number four. You're all familiar with this section, I'm sure. I mean, 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. The Hallmark chapter, that's right. Let me read part of it here. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient, love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. I've never quite understood how people could put this on a greeting card because I don't... It's such a monumental picture that's being painted. It's, you know, it's kind of like sending people, you know, these rosy greetings saying, you know, read it and weep.
Yeah,
I mean,
you
know, by the way, you know, have you taken a look in the mirror lately or something, you know? Right. I mean, this is a profound picture he's painting, and it is a profound picture. That's what I have to say. But what he's doing here in this part is he's saying that a mistake, or a particular aspect of this mistake of thinking that the lack of any spiritual gift could be of ultimate importance, he's suggesting that love is a thing that is of ultimate importance in comparison with any of the gifts. So the mistake is thinking that the lack of any spiritual gift could be as important as lacking love, which they seem to do. I mean, what's striking here is they're at each other's throats, judging each other over the issue of these gifts, when he's saying that you could do without all of the gifts and you'd be fine as long as you have love. You've thrown away love and are crowing about the fact that you speak in tongues, which is, I mean, that's just, you got it backwards. Okay, so in terms of the argument, the mistake that they've made, it's something that we can fall into very easily. But in along with the rest of their errors, they have, you know, they kept the box and threw away the treasure that was inside. Now, the second part of this mistake, I think, is what gets captured in this last part of chapter 13. The mistake is to forget that any lack at all in this age will be made up in the next age, except if we lack faith, hope, and love. Now let me read this. Love never fails, but if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak as a child, think as a child, reason as a child. When I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, just as I also have been fully known. But now abide faith, hope, love, these three, but the greatest of these is love. Which is a tremendous passage. I love that part of 1 Corinthians 13. But if I understand what he's suggesting here, he's saying, look, think of childhood. As a child, you lack a whole bunch that you gain when you're an adult. But your childhood things are done away with, not in the sense that you lose them, but in the sense that they grow up, that they're fulfilled. I spoke as a child. When he says, when I became a man, I put away childish things, he doesn't mean he stopped speaking. What he means is his speech went from childhood to adulthood, right? I mean, the childishness went away. But he's suggesting that we're in our childhood now, that this age, our life in this age is just the beginning. And that in comparison, all of us, I mean, take the apostle, take the prophet, take the one who speaks in tongues, take the teacher, take whoever. Whatever the Spirit may be doing in the lives of individuals now to work in the church is just this little teeny piece of what mature adult being a child of God is going to be like. And it is that what we will enter into when Jesus comes again, when the perfect comes that he's describing. Then I will know as much as I have been known now. But he's reminding them here, you don't know very much. Whatever your gift may be, you're seeing in a mirror dimly still. I mean, that's what's going on now. And if you recognize that then, you recognize how totally insignificant it is that one person has one gift or doesn't have another gift or has this role or doesn't have another role, because all of that will be swallowed up in the completion of the salvation of every one of God's children. All of that will be obliterated. So what does it matter? Except there is one thing that does matter, actually three of them, as he says. When you get rid of the stuff that it doesn't matter because it's ultimately going to be done away with by being overwhelmed with something perfect and complete, There is stuff that you can't do away with. There's stuff that remains. It remains now. That is, you can get away with not being an apostle. You can get away with not speaking in tongues. You can get away with not moving mountains. But you can't get away with not having faith, hope, and love. And that's what he's saying. Is that brings us right back to his initial point, is that what's the most significant thing that the Spirit does? It's bringing a person to the point of faith. It's having faith. It's having a hope, believing God's promises and having a hope, and understanding God in such a way that you're pursuing love, that love is what your life is about. Those are the things that you cannot do without. If you don't have those now, then the next age is not going to make up for that lack, because it's going to hold nothing for you. Yes?
Is that agapio, or is that agape? It's agape.
Yeah. Right. That's right. Okay, well, so I could talk about that more, because I love that passage. But let me just... Yes, Roger.
I was just going to say, the man who wrote over half of the New Testament, mm-hmm. says that he knows in part.
Right. Right. That's true. That's right. I think even Paul was saying the same thing of himself. Which gives you pause, because...
how much time we spend our whole lives...
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So I got a ways to go before I'm ignorant enough to measure up here. So.
Isn't there a prophecy like that? I think it's in Zechariah somewhere that says, someday people will not say to each other, know the Lord, but to everyone.
Right. Jeremiah.
Jeremiah.
Yeah. That's right.
What was said earlier in the first class?
Uh-huh.
One of the guys back here talked about entering God's rest.
Right.
And one of the things that came across my mind was the idea that we only know in part.
Uh-huh.
Understand in part, we prophesy in part, we just need. Everything that we do, we only, obviously we're limited because mm-hmm. of our flesh and our sinfulness mm-hmm. and so on. But at the same time, God, by giving us faith, giving us this hope and this love, we never truly learn to function in that faith, hope, and love totally
mm-hmm.
in this life.
That's right.
And it's just like entering his rest. If we truly learn to trust God, then obviously we have entered the rest, at least on a positional basis. However, we have not learned to enter that rest. I don't know if that's what he was trying to say or not, but that's...
Well, I'm not sure. No, I see what you're saying. But I just wouldn't use the rest language that way. Because entering into his rest, as I understand what Hebrews is talking about, is it's like using language like going to heaven or something like that. I mean, I wouldn't use that language exactly either. But, I mean, we're talking about the finish line is over there, and that's the rest. It's not... Yeah, it involves, I will be a certain kind of person when I get there, but just as much, it's arriving at that place where I am that kind of person that it's talking about. The whole point of Hebrews is persevering. Just like Israel should have persevered with God in the wilderness, you know, we're in this journey in the wilderness, and the rest is to be obtained there. But, like I said to him, I don't object to the picture you're painting, because I think, I mean, that's right. I mean, that's a good way to think about it, except I wouldn't use that rest language.
But I think what he was going on with was you're saying that about trusting God. I mean, I got from him what he was saying is that if you trust God, you'll get, God promises you peace and tranquility. And the way to get the peace and tranquility is to trust God. I mean,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reason I don't have peace and tranquility is because I'm making a mess of my life. And if I could only let God have my life, then I wouldn't have to worry about it.
See, I wouldn't agree with that, because it's hardship in his life. But what I'm saying is that even through the hardship, the Lord gives us peace. He mm-hmm. gives us love.
Mm-hmm.
He gives us all the things in which the Holy Spirit needs. He's mm-hmm. given us a down payment.
Right. Well, these qualities that he's talking about, faith, hope, and love here, these are not, these are realities for us, and we are people of faith and hope and love. It's just, you're right, it's very limited in comparison to what it ought to be and could be, but it's, but it is a reality. I mean, that's what he's saying, that, and that's what's so striking and worrisome to him about the attitude of the Corinthians about these gifts, is they're sort of backbiting with each other about all of this stuff, seems to suggest that at least at this point, their lives lack the very thing that he would most be looking for to suggest that they had something real and of substance, and it just doesn't seem to be there. Okay, now, let me make one more point. This number three that we were talking about before, mistaking what would qualify one's spiritual manifestation as more important than another, that's what he comes back to in chapter 14. And let me just briefly allude to this. He says, "Pursue love, yet desire earnestly spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. For the one who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men, but to God. For no one understands, but in his spirit he speaks mysteries. But one who prophesies speaks to men for edification and exhortation and consolation. One who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but one who prophesies edifies the church." And down below he says, "So also you, since you are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek to abound for the edification of the church." Now, what is prophecy and what is speaking in tongues? That's a good question in trying to understand this, but for this, my purposes here, I admit I'm not entirely sure that I know the answer to that. I have a suspicion that I do, but you can just put a black box there. It doesn't matter for the moment what it is that he's talking about. His point is, whatever they are, the difference between them is that one of them is edifying and the other one isn't particularly. And so his concern for them is that this phenomenon of speaking in tongues, even when it's a legitimate spiritual phenomenon from God, is not intended to be something that is really edifying the church. It doesn't teach anybody anything. It doesn't have any content to it. And he's saying, you know, later on he says, "I'd rather speak, you know, five words with my mind," I think is the way he puts it. What he means is, I'd rather have intelligible words that I know what they mean, that I can communicate to somebody, than you know, go on for hours in this language that nobody understands what it means. The purpose of his saying that is to remind them that if they're going to value and be zealous for particular kinds of gifts, they ought to value the ones that edify. Now, that is the picture that we that I wanted to paint. This is the scenario that he's speaking into. These are the kinds of mistakes that he's trying to warn them about. First of all, the mistake of thinking that spirituality is marked by flashy supernatural manifestations like speaking in tongues. No, true spirituality is marked by faith, saying Jesus is Lord. That's what the Spirit does in the lives of all of God's people. That's the thing. If you're going to be impressed by something, be impressed by that, because it's truly impressive. It is. The second mistake is thinking that manifestations of the Spirit will be the same in everyone. No. God has decided to dish this stuff out variously. And you know, we don't know, that's not necessarily his saying that God's going to dish all of these out at all times, just variously within a particular group of people. At least, I'm pretty convinced that at least apostles on that list that he has on there was dished out at one time in history and there are no more. That there's no question of me being an apostle. So if we're going to start talking about prophecy, I don't know whether there's any question of me being a prophet as well. I think not at this point, but we need to be prepared for the fact. The whole point of this is God has decided to do this the way God has decided to do that, to do it, and you need to be prepared for that. So I shouldn't be thinking that there's something wrong with me or that there's something wrong with somebody else if they don't have the particular role in the body of Christ or gift of the Spirit that I think is somehow the zippy one. Okay, yes?
Desire to see your gifts. There's a modern version of number two, I think, or Greek, that has to do with the United States versus Zimbabwe or some other countries. I mean, you hear this all the time, that the reason why the spiritual gifts are not manifested in the United States is because we're just a country that lacks faith.
Right.
And the reason why some other country may be going through that is because God is working there and
is right. tired of us.
Right. Right. Well, he may very well.
That's a good argument. Isn't that a similar thing on a national basis?
Yeah, well, I think you could say that. I mean, what we have to be prepared for, I mean, the potential flaw in that argument, it theoretically could be true, but it's that hidden assumption that if you were a person of faith or if you were a country of faith, then you'd be seeing all of this stuff happen, ignores the idea that that doesn't seem to be the way God did things. So yeah, that argument doesn't necessarily hold up at all. You're right. Okay, yes?
In 14, where he says, he who speaks in tongues edifies himself, mm-hmm. is that a positive or negative statement?
I don't know. there are two ways
it's
of...
It's an analytical statement.
Is he saying he just puffs up himself rather than building up the church?
Yeah.
It occurred to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have my question about 14 in particular is, I don't know... I know that Jack is fairly inclined to think that Paul has a fairly negative view of what's going on in Corinth, and that although he talks about speaking in tongues as something that, you know, can be legitimate, that actually he's kind of implying between the lines that he thinks the whole thing is a crock that's going on here, that it's all just, you know, their paganism masquerading under the guise of the Spirit.
In which he's being very gentle on them, actually.
Right,
he's
right.
He's letting them get away with this right. stuff they should use.
Right, and I don't know whether that's true or not. I think it's possible, but I just haven't been able to decide. And so that would have an impact to me on how I, you know, how pointed are some of these comments intended to be. I'm not sure about that. Okay, mistake number 3. Mistaking what would qualify one spiritual manifestation as more important than another. That it's missing the fact that God intends the most important things that God does, the most important roles that God gives among us, are those roles that have the potential of lovingly edifying somebody else. And in that sense, speaking in tongues has to be the least significant gift of any of them, because it doesn't do that. Mistake number 4, thinking that the lack of any spiritual gift could be of ultimate importance. This is very important, I think. That from Paul's perspective, you know, yeah, it's nice of God to give us a job to do. That's why it's a gift. That's why it's a grace of God to give out these various roles for people to have. But in one sense, it just doesn't matter. If you didn't get anything to do in this whole thing, if you're a person who has faith, hope, and love, you are a person who has everything of significance in this life. I mean, that's what he's trying to get at. And if we don't see that, I think we've really missed an important thrust of what he's saying. And of course, what's so striking about that is, to me, is that, especially that part, you know, the childhood and seeing in a mirror darkly and all of that stuff, the logic that Paul uses there rushes way past the issue of spiritual gifts to everything. It covers everything in this life. I mean, anything that might be of potential satisfaction to me, Paul's basically saying, look, this is childhood. Children just don't get everything. I mean, children are... They're children, and we're all children in that sense. But the issue is, the important thing is, are we going to grow up? Do we have an adulthood to look forward to? And if we do, then the lacks of childhood, those things which are missing or incomplete in childhood, are not significant. They're significant if that's all you got. But if you're going to grow up, then it's just all part of the growing up process. And to me, that's probably one of the things that the Bible has said that has struck a nerve in my thinking as much as anything. Although I know there are a number of things at this point. But I have thought about this a lot. I mean, I have derived great comfort myself from that picture that Paul is painting. But again, it only works. It only comforts you if you really think that adulthood is coming. If you don't have that picture that that's where it's going, then that's really not going to do very much for you. But what he's saying, I think he's warning the Corinthians that they have a very worldly attitude about all of this stuff. That they, you know, because it is so easy. Because there are satisfactions that come from having a significant role to play. I mean, it is very easy to take the opportunity that God might give someone to do something in this life and to look at that and say, yeah, this is what it's all about. Whatever satisfaction I'm deriving from this thing, that's what it's all about. Is getting the satisfaction. And so it's very easy for what something that's supposed to be edifying and spiritual and pointed towards the kingdom of heaven to end up just being a worldly kind of source of gratification, as much as, you know, in that sense it's not all that different than, you know, going to a prostitute or anything else. I mean, it's just taking advantage of what you've got to satisfy what you want. He's suggesting that, I think, that the gifts have become that sort of thing for the Corinthians. They're deriving this personal satisfaction from it. I've got this one and you don't, that kind of thing. And that they've really, in that sense, they're worldly and they've missed the point. That you want to say you have something? If you've got faith, hope, and love, you've got something. Whatever else you don't have is insignificant compared to what you have if you have that. And likewise, if you don't have that, whatever you might get in its place wouldn't be worth having, because in the end it's not going to do anything for you. Okay, so, well, I'm done. That's my spiel on 1 Corinthians, so.
Great.
Thanks.
I was going to ask on number 4, kind of piggybacking on what you ended with, the entire movement, I don't know if it's still a movement or not, and evangelical Christianity, which is the subject actually of errors, or give me the title of the classic in wrong. You know,
I don't remember. Jack came up with all of these.
This number 4, I think, has been so hidden in contemporary evangelicalism that it's exactly the opposite. I mean, I remember going through spiritual gift indicator pamphlets and narrowing down which spiritual gift I must have had, or and that I was never taught that. I was never ever taught that. Oh, by the way, this is passing.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, this will die with you.
Yeah.
And I was always taught, if there's anything you're going to do as a Christian, it's going to have to be when you narrow down your spiritual gift and really pursue it.
Right.
Which is, they grab number 14:1, follow the way of love and eager to desire the spiritual gifts.
Right.
They go AWOL with that.
Right.
I say they, being whoever teaches you,
right,
to just pursue that with the fervor that,
right,
that and leave everything else behind, because that's, not only is that what's going to, it's going to mature your Christianity, mature your faith, mature your spiritual walk, it's also the really only section of your spiritual life you need to, it's what you really need to grow up in. It's your whole thing.
Yeah.
And if you don't narrow it down, if you don't figure it out, if you don't find out, keep going, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, that's, obviously, that's another whole side of the question that I didn't really address tonight. Because
I think you really did.
Well, what I'm saying is there's a question. I haven't explored that question. Actually, what is a spiritual gift, and are you supposed to go figuring out which one you've got and all of that stuff? Because I'm not convinced that whole model really is right in terms of.
I think number 4, when you brought that up, that shows that question mark.
Right. No, I agree, but it kind of, in broad terms, it kind of shows the fallacy of thinking that way.
Right.
But what we haven't done is looked specifically at the question, okay, so what does he mean by spiritual gifts, and what should I do? I mean, does it make any sense to go through the list and say, which one of these did I get, and that kind of stuff? And,
well, there's a couple things. One thing is that in our culture, and this happens in the church because we're part of the culture, this is part of a human thing. It's like a halfback. The quarterback hands the ball to him and he starts running with it. And it's just run. You just try to avoid the tackles and you just keep going. You don't stop to think about what you're doing, that you're going to get smashed or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I, for years, I went through the 70s, I went through the Jesus movement down in L.A., and I was involved in charismatic churches, you know, quite a few of them. Some that I respect very highly, some that I question, including the Vineyard, and so on. And my experience, and the one thing that I've learned through that, is one of the things in which they go wrong, where they went wrong, and I got caught up into, not that I got caught up myself, but I always had a trouble with, was the idea that, hey, you know, we're going to force this gift down you,
right.
Number one. Or number two, you've got to force God or yourself or whatever to have the spiritual gift.
Right.
Rather than letting God being God.
Yeah.
God is sovereign. If he wants to give somebody a gift, I don't care if it's a tongue, a prophecy, or whatever gift he may have, exhortation, whatever it is, he is the one who's got to give that gift to a person. And it must also be in humbleness, too.
Yeah, I've never been able to reconcile, and I don't know, I mean, I know they have answers to these questions, but I'm just not satisfied with what I've heard. But I know that someone like John Wimber says, I don't care who it is, I know everyone I've prayed for to get the gift of tongues always gets it. You know, it's kind of like a challenge. You kind of want to go, say, okay, so try it on me. You know? Yeah. So, but I don't know how to reconcile that sort of attitude with what I see here. I mean, it just doesn't seem to be how Paul is picturing this at all. So,
the other thing is the implication that you're of that mindset that your entire part of the body is on hold until you get this almost perfected in whatever it is.
Right. Well, I need to stop and.